Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Koch, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan, investigative and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues across our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we're working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by housing reporter Caitlin Andrews, education reporter Christian Moravec, and Report for America Corps member Dan O'Connor, who covers rural government for us in a partnership with the Bangor Daily News. We'll be talking about their recent reporting on a fund that would help towns convert empty schools into housing, a new approach to teaching reading, and a police department that is using AI to draft reports. Caitlin, first of all, welcome. We're so excited to have you back at the Monitor and covering such a critical beat in Maine, housing.
Yeah, thank you, Kate. And I'm so happy to be back with you guys as well. One of the things I'm always interested in is that I think that there is so many different ways to tackle it, right? Like we often see people focused largely on the affordability issue or the supply issue, but you can talk about mortgage rates, you can look at construction material costs, you can have conversations about workforce, and all of those usually relate back to housing. So I'm really excited to see all the different ways that we can approach this and try to take a more like thoughtful and holistic view to housing.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. We really are at a change point here, and it'll be very interesting to see what you dig up for us as you start on this beat. All right, so Caitlin, you recently wrote about a proposal that could help towns convert empty school buildings into housing. Tell us about the idea that lawmakers in the state are looking into.
Yeah, so this bill, it's LD 2164, would specifically create a $5 million fund that the Maine Land Redevelopment Authority could use to help municipalities that are looking at converting schools into housing. Now, the way that they would help these schools specifically is with helping with something that they call last mile projects. So these are costs like maybe doing engineering work or some site cleanup, or basically these projects that can be kind of small in the overall redevelopment scheme that, you know, maybe a developer is having a hard time getting funding for, or they've been able to get funding for most of the project, but it's just these little remaining costs that they need in order to get these projects to pencil out. You know, the state kind of characterizes them as projects that wouldn't be able to make sense otherwise.
How much money are we talking about in this bill?
$5 million.
$5 million. Okay. And why are they specifically interested in converting schools to housing?
Yeah, so there is a couple of reasons. First, you know, communities usually have some sort of a emotional connection to schools, either because people used to go there and they have fond memories of it, or even if they have not been there for a while, they might be used to seeing a lot of energy and activity around these buildings and the idea of them just kind of sitting vacant and gathering dust just kind of bumps people out. They want to see something happen with them. They are often very architecturally interesting buildings, depending on what age that they were built. They could be really unique. The layout of schools can sometimes lend themselves well to specifically housing like apartments. Another reason is that these projects, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, can be expensive to reform, and often municipalities just need help getting them over the finish line. And then you have the situation that is going on in Maine's education. You know, enrollment has been dropping year over year. I believe it's been about 6.6% over a decade. And the governor actually launched a commission on school construction to get a sense of what's been going on with these schools. Because as enrollment has dropped, a lot of school districts either consolidate or they send their kids to another district altogether. And an additional reason is that schools have been closing because of enrollment challenges. You know, we have seen that enrollment has dropped 6.6% over a decade, and a lot of times schools will decide to either consolidate or send their students elsewhere in order to deal with that. And sometimes these schools also close because their maintenance costs become very prohibitive for a lot of these small school districts. The governor actually released a report this year on school construction that found that 497 school buildings either needed some sort of a major structural overhaul or new construction, or they might have needed a costly improvement like a new energy system or code updates. And the total cost to update all of those buildings was estimated to be about $11 billion. Now, some districts might be able to handle costs like that, but others, as I said, that is just too much money. So rather than trying to fix these buildings, they opt to close them altogether. And in a lot of cases, if it's too expensive for them to make these upgrades, it's also very expensive to even maintain them, you know, keep lights on or keep heating on them to make sure something like the pipes don't burst. So in a lot of cases, these buildings end up just falling into disrepair, and they might need even more work to convert them into something else.
I live in Bar Harbor, and I think like all of those issues you just described are just so evident here. I mean, we have a housing crisis. We are also in the middle of talking about potentially reorganizing our school district, and we have a renovation project for our current elementary school that I think in the many tens of millions of dollars right now. So I really this is yeah this is really fascinating, and I think like I just see these issues in my own life. Well, I also live not too far from our town hall, which is was formerly the high school many I think several decades ago, but it's a beautiful old historic building and has been repurposed. So what tell us a little bit more about this fund that's being proposed. Like, what kind of housing project would it support?
So it would support any housing projects that a municipality could get support for. You know, Maine has been very clearly driving towards its affordable housing crisis for the last several years. It's obviously been a priority at the state and the legislative level, but the Maine Redevelopment Land Bank Authority is also very clear that we are not a affordable housing program. We are trying to get these buildings back onto the tax rolls in any way possible. So while they certainly might are supportive of the idea of creating affordable housing, it is not the only thing that this money would go towards. And the fund would also very specifically work with municipalities who have control of these buildings. And that is important because sometimes school districts, you know, hold on to possession of these buildings. A town usually has to vote if they want to take the building back from a school district. And that can be controversial sometimes because voters, you know, who are already facing challenges related to property taxes or paying for their school districts might not necessarily want to take on the burden of a school building that has been in disrepair for years.
Sure. Yeah, can understand that. And you said so. This is still this funding is like last mile things, like you described as well. So it's fairly specific in what it actually would fund. What is the status of the bill right now?
So the bill was voted out of the Housing and Economic Development Committee in early March. It looks like right now it has not been taken up by the legislature. And that vote was along party lines. You know, you saw Democrats supporting it for the idea of anything that can kind of help create more housing in the state is good. And Republicans were voted against it. Some of the things that they expressed concern about was the specificity of the fund in that it only works with municipalities and not school districts.
Interesting. And one of, you know, obviously you've mentioned this group before, but one of the main groups involved in this whole idea is the Maine Redevelopment Land Bank Authority. You talked a little bit about it up above, but I had never heard of this. So tell listeners what this authority does and a little bit more about how they go looking for potential sites to develop.
So the Land Bank Authority's mission is to help municipalities get buildings that may have been languishing on the tax rolls back into use. Like I said, housing is one of the things that they are interested in, but they can also help redevelop commercial projects. They might take a site into the Land Bank Authority and then help to develop it from there. Like, for instance, they are helping with redeveloping a tannery project in Hatfield, and for school districts in Van Buren and Union and Brooks, they are working specifically with them to try to convert some of their schools into housing. And they have a kind of a tough job ahead of them in trying to find all the schools that could potentially fall under this fund. I mean, they told me that they basically sort through historical documents. They might look at a news report to see if a school has closed. Some of them they come across just organically in stakeholder calls. Some they just kind of stumble across, very incidentally. I think the executive director told me a story of when he was in, I believe it was Norway, and he found a trove of historical newspapers and just happened to pick one up, and it was talking about a school that had closed. And they were like, we didn't even hear about a lot of these because the state's records only go back to, I believe it's about 2016, of like when schools have been closed. So if a school district closed their school 20 years ago, they might not even have a record that that school district closed that school. And in some cases, that school might not even have like an address or be like registered with the town in that way. So you actually can't even find where it used to be.
Sounds like kind of a fun job. So tell us about some of the schools that the Land Bank Authority has identified so far that might be good candidates for this.
Yeah. So, like I said, they are specifically right now working with Van Buren, Union, and Brooks to try to get some projects going with some of their former schools. They are located kind of all over the state, ranging from all the way up in Arista County, along like the coast in the down east area. There's a few of them down in more of like southern Maine and some scattered over into western Maine. At the time when I had written my story, they had been able to identify about 27 schools that were sitting vacant.
The story is linked in the episode notes for this, and anyone who's interested can, of course, go read the story on the mainmonitor.org. And there's a great map that Caitlin put together, which shows all of these schools that are potentially, potential sites for housing as of early March 2026. It's got all the, a little blurb for each one. So I urge people to go check it out. It really gives you a sense of where some of these buildings are. And so let's talk a little bit more about like what this would actually look like on the ground, because it's, the school buildings are very purpose-built spaces. They are not, they're not like a lot of other buildings. They have a lot of unique characteristics about them. So, and as you mentioned, a lot of these buildings are really historic and were built, decades, maybe in some cases even a century ago. So what, talk to us a little bit about some of the challenges that developers told you come with redeveloping buildings like this.
Yeah, so I spoke to Eric Chinberg with Chinberg Properties, and one of the things that he talked to me about is that, for one, a lot of these projects might be located in areas that maybe don't make them as good candidates for federal financing or these low-income tax credits. These credits are very competitive for developers, and they often look at a lot of things like walkability or access to services, even things like the projected cost of a project. If a project is going to be super expensive. The awarders of these tax credits might say, I don't know if we are going to be able to help here. As we've mentioned, renovating these schools can be very expensive. And that can range from a couple of different reasons. Like we said, if they've been sitting vacant for a while, they could have structural issues. They could have experienced flooding and need some sort of water cleanup. Depending on the age, there might be asbestos concerns, which is very expensive to, remediate. And sometimes the developers might not be interested in a building because of its shape and what kind of infrastructure things it has going on. For instance, a older, architecturally interesting building might in turn be very small. And if you're a developer, you might not want to spend a bunch of money creating 22 apartments, which ultimately may not result in a whole lot of profit for you. And because those buildings are so small, they might be difficult to renovate to add features like an elevator or something else like that that would improve the quality of living. On the flip side, some buildings that might have been built in the 60s or 70s are architecturally, not that appealing. These big cinder block sites that probably have a lot of space, but would not be very attractive to live in and not very interesting. But those things can also sometimes be pros, especially the architecturally interesting element of them. The fact that the classrooms are laid out in a very specific way can sometimes help you convert into apartments easier. And they can kind of be like pet projects for people.
I remember this is obviously not schools, but I do remember reading quite a bit about how to convert office buildings into housing and how complicated it is. Like there were a lot of unexpected things that I wouldn't have considered, like fluorescent lighting. It can be really hard to change that over. There's yeah, it's just it's fat. I think oftentimes we like walk down the street, we see a building, you think we need more housing. That building is empty. Like, couldn't we convert it? But it isn't. It's not nearly as simple as we might want it to be.
In a lot of cases, it might be more easier for them to just raise the building to the ground and start fresh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess anybody who has owned a house and done a renovation project probably
Has thought about that once or twice, yeah.
has thought about we're in the midst of renovating our house and outside of it, and I have definitely thought to myself, man, if I had the money, I would just knock this whole thing over and start over. Now, are you aware, Caitlin, of any successful renovations of schools into housing in Maine?
One that comes to mind is the Hilltop Heights Senior Living, which used to be a Hilltop Elementary School in Caribou. A couple of years ago, Caribou consolidated its elementary schools, and I believe they ended up tearing down three of them. But the fourth one, they turned into the senior housing. My understanding is that it's very popular, and that there's actually like a wait list for that one. But I really found a few examples of these schools being converted into something more similar to their previous lives, which was, like a community center. I think of specifically in Corinna, where they changed the building into a kind of mixed-use community area. And one of the reasons that these buildings are attractive as community centers is that a lot of times it could be easier to convert them into housing. You think about housing, you need really specific needs, like you need a bathroom for every unit. You might need ADA accessibility. Again, there's converting the spaces into like more interesting apartment shapes, but a community center, many times you already have something like a gym. You might have a kitchen attached to it and you can hold events and things like that. If you want to hold adult education classes, you already have classrooms set up like that. And the conversion costs are probably relatively minimal as opposed to starting all over with housing.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I can see that being true. So tell us about one school that you looked at. You looked at one in Van Buren. What did the town officials have to say about that building?
Yeah, so the town manager told me that it was a building he had inherited when he started his job about 3 years ago. And the Gateway Elementary School had been empty for about 15 years or so. And while he said that it was well pickled, it had been well insulated and well heated. So even when it was not being, actively maintained, he said that it was able to be in pretty good shape. It was a project that they could never quite get a developer to go all the way on. He said that there was a lot of expense and like labor involved in trying to find the building's original floor plans and getting engineers to assess it. So developers would express interest and then do a lot of lay work and ultimately back out because they had spent so much money and you hadn't even really been able to get to a development phase. Which they would really like to see something happen with that building. It seems like his interest specifically was maybe some sort of a mixed thing that could serve either elderly populations, but also still maintain like a recreation center or have something where it could have a bit more of a mixed use.
You also looked at a school in Brooks, and you were able to kind of dig into the historical records there. Tell us about that and what the situation is now.
Right, the Morse Memorial School was originally conceived as a sort of like a consolidated school with room for elementary students on the first floor and room for the high schoolers on the second. It was built in the 1930s and closed just a few years ago, largely because of consolidation reasons. The school population there was pretty small. And so the situation is that it has been sitting quietly, it has been sitting empty for a few years now, and the town just recently made the decision to acquire the building from the school district, which they can do at no cost. But then they are faced with the question of what do they want to do with it, right? Like once you acquire the building, you are responsible for maintaining it, for making sure that it remains closed off to the public so that nobody can access it. And from there, once they acquire it, they have to ask themselves, what do they want to happen with it next? And this is where it gets kind of interesting because they had done a community survey, and the community was largely interested in seeing it as a sort of community space, right? They were mostly interested in a recreation center or some sort of continuing education. There was some interest in turning it into housing, but the housing would be the most expensive renovation of the project, whereas something like keeping it in a community or education use would be the most cheap thing. So that's going to be a question they'll have to answer later on. And it's also possible that they could end up selling it, right? If a developer is interested in taking on the project, then they could sell it to the developer.
That would be fascinating. You said you when you wrote the story, they had yet to vote on what they wanted to do, but they have since voted. What did they decide?
Yeah, so on March 21st, they did decide to take the building back from the school district and they decided to maintain it for a year, which meant that they agreed to raise about $75,000 to do things like insure it and keep the electric on and things like that. And one of the town's planning board members, Ray Quimby, kind of described it, people as being very supportive of it. He said the vote was 76 to 14 to take it and maintain money for it.
So is that $75,000 annually?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, I am very curious to hear about as you continue reporting on this topic, how this all goes. And thank you so much for, taking a few minutes to talk to us about this story that you wrote. We are gonna take a quick break here. If you are just joining us, you are listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. This month, I am talking to Maine Monitor housing reporter Caitlin Andrews, education reporter Christian Moravec, and Report for America core member Dan O'Connor, who covers rural government for the Monitor in partnership with the Bangor Daily News. All right, Christian, I'd love to turn to you. And we're going to keep talking about schools, although kind of a different aspect, the schools that are still in service and have students in them. So you recently wrote about RSU 14, which serves kids in Windham and Raymond. And you learned that an employee in that school district created her own curriculum to help students learn a foundational skill for reading. So first, can you just tell us what that foundational skill is?
Yeah, so I'll try to explain this as clearly as possible, though I'll, and avoid going down the rabbit hole of the reading world, which is very complex. But specifically, phonemic awareness is when a child is able to break down words by their sounds and is also able to put those sounds back together. Those skills are often referred to also as segmenting and blending. So I might use those terms a couple times as well. And this has long been considered an essential skill for learning how to read and write well, as it helps children understand how words are structured, according to research. And this was reaffirmed when the National Reading Panel, which was tasked by Congress in the late 90s to address and look at literacy research for schools, it released a report in 2000 that reviewed tons of reading research that was out there. And essentially established phonemic awareness as one of those kind of key fundamental skills that children need to grasp when they're young to, in order to be readers successfully later on in their lives. And some of those other skills might include phonics, which is something probably a lot of people are familiar with. It's a related alphabetical skill to phonemic awareness. There's also fluency, vocabulary, stuff like that. And just to kind of set some context for, why we talk about these types of skills in the first place. I mean, there's been, I would say, a decades-long debate about how we teach kids how to read, and how much of these different types of skills should be a key component in reading curricula. There's been a lot of debate that some reading curricula have not successfully been teaching kids how to read because they don't address some key skills. For instance, many people might be familiar with the fact that there are many popular reading curricula that have not taught enough of phonics, which can be detrimental to children if they are trying to learn how to read. And this debate is particularly relevant to Maine. Our national standardized testing shows that our students are struggling with reading and increasingly so over the years. Reading scores for fourth graders and eighth graders have been going down in recent years, where we used to be a pretty high performer nationally. And then state standardized testing, you can't compare those results year over year, unfortunately, just because the state standardized test has changed a couple times in the past decade. But, recent testing does show that still a good chunk of students who the state starts testing them at the third grade level, a good chunk of those students are not performing proficiently in language arts.
I'm going to be honest, I had to look up how to pronounce phonemic when I saw the draft of this story. And it was really fascinating because I grew up in an area where I remember phonics very well. That was a big part of my childhood. But phonemic awareness was not something that I remember encountering. So it was really, yeah, it was really, really fascinating to hear more about that. And now, so you talked to an educator named Kirsten Chomsky, who is the instructional coach at RSU 14, and she wrote this curriculum, which is called Sounds of Success. Tell us a little bit about the curriculum and why she decided to make it.
Yeah, so I'll kind of start with the why, because it kind of goes back to that broader debate over reading curricula. In the case of RSU 14, Educators here knew that they had to implement some form of phonemic awareness training for their students, but they felt like they didn't have anything that was readily available that addressed everything a teacher would want in a curricula in a curriculum. A curriculum would need like assessments, ways to intervene if a student was struggling particular skill sets, and in many cases, when teachers lack something with a curriculum, they just have to kind of try to come up with something and kind of patch things together. And so they had also argued that the curricula that are out there didn't dive into phonemic awareness deep enough. And so this is kind of what prompted Kirsten Chansky to author her own curriculum. She said this work kind of started years ago when she was still teaching at a younger grade level. She noticed that some students were struggling. And no matter what she as a teacher did, no matter how parents were trying to intervene, and even the students were trying to work hard to catch up, like there were still students who were slipping through the cracks. And so that kind of prompted her to spend the time to kind of dive into the research that was out there. And over time, she kind of started implementing exercises in her classroom, coming up with frameworks, kind of inspired from some other curricula that she had seen, and also inspired by the research and kind of piecing together like this practice that she could use in the classroom that built this skill for students. That work expanded beyond her classroom to other classrooms, and it just kept expanding until she decided to just author and finalize a draft for this curriculum last year. And what this curriculum looks like is really it just takes just a couple minutes out of a day, could be used a couple times a week, which is ideal for teachers who are teaching at younger grade levels, such as kindergarten and first grade. Those, of course, are going to be very busy teachers. They can just add this curriculum into their day. And what that might look like is a teacher going over words orally. So they might segment out words, sounds in a word to their class, have that class put those sounds together, and then vice versa. And then the students will also see words and letters on a screen and break down words that way. So they're kind of giving both an oral exercise and they're also doing some reading in this curriculum as well. And since Chansky has begun piloting in the school. It's spread to some other school districts. So it's being piloted in five other school districts in Maine. And she has also since gotten it certified through the Every Student Succeeds Act. That is the federal guideline for academic standards in the US. And so, yeah, it's kind of getting some traction here.
Yeah, I'm actually, I don't know how much you delved into this in your reporting, but how does a person go about getting a curriculum certified? I mean, can anybody write a curriculum? Can you tell us a little bit more about what you know from your reporting on that?
Yeah, we didn't dive too deeply into this, although it was interesting to learn how she basically self-published this curriculum. And then she worked with Johns Hopkins University to assess it. And so for ESSA certification, that's again referencing that federal guideline, there are like different tiers of certification. And so I think she certified for the level four, which I believe might be like the first tier of certification that you gain. And so you have to provide data for that. Right now they're working through a study of how effective this curriculum is in partnership with Johns Hopkins as well, as part of this ESSA certification.
That's fascinating. I guess I sort of imagined curriculum development to be more of like a top-down thing, but this is very much a bottom-up, you know, she saw a problem in the classroom and went to solve it, which is fascinating. Now, and you actually went and saw this in action, right? You went into her classroom and observed the students, right?
Yeah, so I didn't go into her classroom. Right now, she's just an instructional coach, but she was able to organize the time for me to sit in on three different classes that were using this curriculum across two different schools in the district. And so I sat in on two kindergarten classes and one preschool class that was also actually using this. And so that was pretty interesting to see. The kids seem very enthusiastic about this curriculum. One class I sat in, the kids were like, jumping as they like broke down the letter sounds, which is very cute. One kid in the preschool class, I was watching them kind of go through their segmenting and blending skills. And when they were like reading the words on the screen, they were working on, I guess, what I would consider to be very advanced words for a child at that age, like breaking down the sounds in the word sigh, which of course has that silent G and that H in it. And, they're reading the word if as well and breaking that down. And one child kind of shouted out, when he heard, like, saw, like, the word if on the screen, he was like, "That's one of my sight words." And it was just very cute, how kind of all like these reading skills that they're getting both at home and in skill or in school, excuse me, are kind of coming together, in one lesson.
So I, that it's tricky, right? My older daughter is 3 and a half, and she really wants to learn how to read, and I am suddenly struck by like how actually complicated it is to teach this skill when I'm trying to, show her words on the page and sound them out and explain like what this is. There's really a lot that goes into it. Now, so how's the program going so far? Tell us a little bit about that.
I mean, aside from the kids that I saw clearly enjoying it, I spoke with a handful of educators at RSU14, and I spoke with one curriculum coordinator at RSU55, and they essentially rave about this program. They find it incredibly helpful, which I thought was interesting. It's easy to implement, per their words. I work, or excuse me, I spoke with the district coordinator. Curriculum coordinator RSU14, she said that she couldn't find anything that she could buy that had all of this ready for phonemic awareness. So she was really happy about that. And so, they're pretty excited about what this type of curriculum might mean in the long term. They are tracking kind of the benchmark testing. That's kind of referring back to that that study that the district is doing in partnership with Johns Hopkins. There are three kindergarten classes who are kind of being studied. Like they're how should I put this? Their ability to grow the skill set in phonemic awareness. They're tracking how that is going throughout the year as they use this curriculum. And so these three kindergarten classes, they were tested at the beginning of the year using nonsense words. And they're using nonsense words to assess how these students are doing so that no student can basically rely on previous knowledge or exposure to a word they might otherwise use, and make sure that the student can actually blend and segment these sounds in the word. Basically, prove that they actually have the skill of phonemic awareness, which is interesting. And so those nonsense words might be words like pim or sut. So still simple enough for a young child to figure out, but not something that they would otherwise already know. And so when they did this first assessment at the beginning of the year, of course, many of the students kind of were hitting like maybe just at the benchmark and below. And then later in the year, they did their second round of testing just a couple of months ago, after, quite a few months of using this curriculum. A lot of the students exceeded the middle of the year benchmark, and many of them also exceeded the end of the year benchmark. And so I don't believe they've gone through the third test because they're going to be tested three times just yet, based on the last time I spoke with folks at the district. But those results have folks pretty excited. These kids are too young to be tested at the standardized testing level, so this is kind of the data that they're working with to kind of track progress. But I think a lot of people have faith that this might show good results in a couple of years when these kids are in the older grades that will get tested.
Well, that strikes me. That sounds very different from something that I've read quite a bit about in recent months, of where kids are taught to use like context clues,
As opposed to actually trying to like learn and sound out the words. So that sounds like sort of a very different method.
Yeah, the context clue part is interesting because that is a practice that and for some curricula that was out there was based with the idea that kids can learn how to read naturally the same way they learn how to speak. But researchers have long found that reading is not a natural phenomenon for children, and that you do have to build these skills, such as being able to sound out the words and understand how they're structured in order to be successful readers.
Yeah, I know. I do sort of I would give my daughter books and think like maybe she'll just learn this. But yeah, no, I that not no, for her anyway, that has not been the case. Well, Christian, thank you so much. That's really interesting to learn about. We are gonna turn over to Dan now. Dan, this was a fascinating story that you wrote. A little while ago now, about a police department in Western Maine that was the first in the state and one of the first in the country, actually, right, to start using a new AI program to draft police reports. So I'm just really curious, how did you first hear about this?
Yeah, so I cover rural government across the state, so I had encountered similar technology before. There's a big company called Axon that makes a whole variety of police tech, like I think they own the Taser brand, etc. And they have an AI police report system. But they're kind of a black box, and so it's hard to get through to such a big company. Whereas I heard through an email that there was a much smaller company, a young startup that had been piloting a program in Wilton, Maine, which was interesting for a number of reasons. First, Wilton, Maine is a strange first stop for a company that is based in California. The CEO of this company is a 19-year-old college dropout. And last, they were emailing me about it, which is very much not the experience you have when you're trying to email their competitors, these big companies. So I responded and, started asking questions. And then the story just kind of grew from there. And it turned out that Code4 was unique in a lot of ways, separate from its competition.
I honestly, I didn't know where Wilton was until you brought it to my attention. I've learned a lot, as you can see, through all of this reporting. It's really the fun part of my job. So, did you get into any insight into why Wilton as this first
Yeah,
place?
so this company had been cold calling police departments across the country, just trying to find departments who might be interested in piloting their software. And I believe Wilton was like the fourth or fifth to actually respond to this. So at the time, they had very few police departments on board, and the police chief in Wilton was interested. He said his department had been sort of snowed in with backup of police reports that needed to be dealt with, and so he replied to a cold email from the company, and it went from there.
And it's a pretty young CEO and young startup, right? Have they been
Yeah,
around for very
the
long? Yeah.
company is coming up on its first birthday, and the CEO, I believe, is coming up on his 20th. So pretty young
Yeah.
both ways.
Yeah. Wow, I was not doing anything that cool when I was 20.
Me neither.
You mentioned there are other companies, really big companies, that do something similar, but this software is kind of unique, right? How does it work?
Yeah, so several departments in Maine use Axon's technology, which is called Draft One, and it generates police report drafts based on the audio from a body camera. But Code4, which is the startup, uses audio and video from the body cameras. That's unusual for a lot of reasons. AI is still fairly new, and AI analysis of video is even newer. And so, this is really sort of a cutting edge piece of technology, or at least it's marketed to be.
And what was the, what was the reasoning for the Wilton police chief? Just like really, they were totally overwhelmed and they needed some help with these reports.
Yeah, they had some backlog, and so when George Chang, who's the CEO, he reached out, the police department took him up on the offer and has been making suggestions about what could improve, and they've said that those suggestions have been taken, and over time, over the months, Code 4's technology has gotten better, they've told me, and so far no complaints from the department.
But what I'm sure we have all heard a lot about AI
Yes.
recently. It's been creeping into all of my devices, I think. And it is not perfect. So
That is true.
tell us a little bit about how those imperfections might impact this type of work in particular.
Yeah, so of course, anyone who's done a Google search lately will know that AI generates answers for you based on large language models, and that can sometimes be inaccurate because it's not really thinking the way a person thinks. But that can be a problem for something important like a police report, obviously. So the agreement, or the premise from this company and others like it, is that essentially, because a police officer is signing off at the draft at the end of the day, they are still responsible for the accuracy of the report that they submit. So that means they have to check through everything that the first draft says to make sure it's true and it matches up with their memory. Now, the question is, how do they do that? Code 4 and companies like that actually use the AI's ability to generate falsehoods to their advantage. So every draft report from Code 4 has false or extraneous information that is flagged by the system. And if the officers do not remove it, they can't submit their report. So basically, that's designed to ensure that officers are checking. But that doesn't eliminate the possibility of unintended errors, or the AI generating a different perspective that isn't exactly what the police officer might have written. And so that raises some questions about the accuracy of a police report that's generated, at least in the first draft, by an unthinking machine.
Yeah, I mean, I think, the story goes into some interesting detail here. You can could you talk a little bit about just sort of in the course of police work, right? You might be like on the side of a highway. Like how might that impact this, the report that this generates?
Right. So often these encounters that police are having are in messy situations or loud situations. And so even with just audio, it can be difficult for the body camera footage to pick everything up accurately. And so that's, again, part of why the officer review is so essential, is that the camera itself might not have picked up anything accurately. So generally how it works is that Wilton police officers all have body cameras, and so at the end of a shift, or after they're done responding to an incident, they will put their body camera into a thing, a little machine, and it will automatically upload the data from that camera into Code 4 software. It then, quote unquote, watches the video and listens, in quotes, to the audio and tries to generate a narrative based on that. So that's their first draft, and it can be tricky, or some have raised concerns that it might be tricky to determine whether it's picking up something real or false, especially in messy situations. So there's another software, this is not Code 4, but in Utah, that had generated a police report that said that one of the officers had transformed into a frog. Now, it
Oh
was
no.
figured out eventually that the princess and the frog, or something like that, was playing in the background, and it got confused about the conversations going on.
My goodness.
So again, it's not a human. It can't think critically in the way that we do. And so that potential for errors exists even just with audio. And so when you add video to the mix, it gets potentially even riskier, or the potential for issues like that arise.
Well, it's funny, but it's not that's not great.
Luckily, there they caught that before
They
they submitted
caught
the
it.
draft, but it can happen.
Well, we need to take a quick break here. If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Main Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. It's a programs collaboration between WERU FM and the Main Monitor. And this month, we are talking to housing reporter Caitlin Andrews, education reporter Christian Moravec, and Report for America Corps member Dan O'Connor, who covers rural government for us in partnership with the Bangor Daily News. And we are talking to Dan right now about a story about a police department in Wilton, Maine, that is using AI to help generate its police reports. So, Dan, now this Wilton's been using this technology for a little while now. I think your story said it's one of about 50 departments in the country that's using this particular version called Code 4. So far, they're not paying for it. What is the district attorney in the area have to say about all this?
Yeah, so the district attorney actually had not been aware of Code 4 or that any department in his district was using AI to generate police report drafts until I called him. So he had said that they should maybe not be doing that yet and that there would be conversations to come. So it's still not clear around the country where this is being tested, how it's going to be received by courts, what prosecutors will think, what defendants will think, what defense attorneys will think. And so it's really a new frontier of law. And these police reports are often central to court cases that prosecutors use. And so it's a real concern for prosecutors across the country if that source of information is generated by AI. And we still don't know how that will pan out. Some places elsewhere in the country have started to react to this. I believe it was in Washington State. There was some pushback to using AI generated body camera footage, or sorry, AI generated police reports. And so it remains to be seen how that will play out here in Maine.
Yeah, what have researchers and civil rights groups said about the technology so far?
Yeah, so when it comes to civil rights, there's always concern around police using a new technology, around over-policing, around inaccuracies surrounding this technology. But what I think is especially interesting is the research, because right now there's very little of it. There's no independent research on Code 4's software. At least one researcher I talked to also had not heard of Code 4 when I reached out to him. But he's one of the leading experts on AI in policing. And he pointed me towards some early research that says that even the time savings from this technology is potentially very limited because of those potential inaccuracies and because of the fact that police officers have to check their drafts so thoroughly. That can sometimes take longer than writing a police report would take. Some of these police reports are simple traffic incidents, and they don't necessarily always take a very long time to write. But if the AI generates a more complicated draft, or it has falsehoods in it, or whatever, the police officer then has to sit down and work on that in a way that potentially could be frustrating. So there's still very, very little research on AI-generated police reports, and it remains to be seen whether it saves time, as companies like Code4 claim, and how it plays out, of course, in reality.
And just to be clear, so are there the Wilton police are all wearing body cameras. Are they using this for every single report?
No. So only about half the department is piloting the program right now. They have not clarified for me exactly which reports they're using this for, but as far as I'm aware, they are of the officers that use the technology, they are using this to draft any and potentially all reports.
And I know you talked a little, you touched on this briefly, about attorneys and, what they've said about what this could mean for police reports that are being used as evidence in court. But can you just speak to that a little bit more and what you learned there?
Yeah, well, it's really hard to say because, again, nobody really knows. And that's what makes this, I think, so interesting is that, we are at the frontier of this, and it's unclear how these will hold up in court if an AI generated error winds up in a courtroom, that could potentially damage or destroy a case. We've yet to see if that happens, but it's definitely something people are concerned about. But even if a police report generated by AI is completely accurate, it's not clear that they would stand up either, because a defense attorney could potentially convince somebody or a jury that it's generated by AI and therefore you shouldn't trust it. That's not an totally out of left field argument, because most people are aware now that AI can hallucinate and it can make things up. And so, if you can undermine the trust in the police report, potentially you could undermine a prosecutor's case entirely. Now, that's all pretty speculative because, again, this hasn't really played out on a massive scale here in Maine. But yeah, it's a real frontier, and that makes it a risk, but also an opportunity for communities looking into this technology.
And I think I mentioned this briefly earlier, but the CEO is not yet charging for the software, right? Wilton is getting this for free. So,
Yes.
yeah, what do you know about plans by this company to get other departments on board and to grow?
Yeah, so obviously their plan is a pretty big expansion. They didn't just email Wilton when they first started reaching out in Maine. I believe that they tried bigger towns and cities like Portland and Bangor, and they've still expressed hope that they might be able to, get through to some of those police departments that might have potentially bigger contracts. But so far in Wilton, there is no contract. The company has given the Wilton Police Department a year of access to this software, presumably in the hopes that they will then sign on for a contract when that year trial ends. So, their strategy is really just to get their foot in the door in the state and then hope that that police department can, spread the idea or plant the seed of Code 4 being used in other departments. And already a neighboring department in J is looking at potentially using Code 4. I haven't heard anything recently on that, but they had discussions with the company and with the chief in Wilton. So that strategy might be working.
Do you know when the trial for Wilton is up?
Ooh, I don't, but it will be at some point this year.
Okay. And do you have any insight into the name Code 4? What is that referring to?
Oh yeah, well, Code 4 is apparently, I didn't know this, I learned this, but it's police lingo for everything's fine. It's like what they say over the radio when the situation is under control, I guess. And so, they're sort of conveying the everything is fineness of using AI in police reporting.
Oh, that's interesting. Thank you. Yeah, I was not aware of that. Well, thank you so much, Dan. I really appreciate you telling us about that, taking us a little bit into your reporting behind that story. It's really fascinating, and I am so curious to see what happens next. You have been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by reporters Caitlin Andrews, Christian Moravec, and Dan O'Connor. You can read their work at themainmonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. If you have ideas you want to share with the reporters, you can find their emails at themainmonitor.org. The Maine Monitor Radio Hour is broadcast on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app. Subscribe to the show as a podcast or download archived shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Koff, and this is Community Radio WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.